Computer. Welcome, everyone. Good to see you all, and hope you've had a good week. Today's class is going to be a continuation of last week's class, and I think we'll find it, at least I'll find it rather interesting. I've been enjoying researching it. So my first question is for you, were you all able to get the notes for today's class? Okay,
yeah.
Excellent. And were you all able to get the notes from last week's class that I gave you last time, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I've started this format in the other classes, so I think I'll continue it here with a little bit of a preamble and a discourse, and then we'll get into the actual discussion. Words, they change over time. For example, we spoke about last week the word skeptic or stoic or Epicurean. All these words today mean things that are very different from what they originally were intended to mean. The connection is very tenuous, which means it's very iffy. Take philosophy, for example. If you look up philosophy today, or you look into philosophy, or you Google philosophy, what you'll find is the philosophy of ethics, the philosophy of logic, the philosophy of politics, the philosophy of love, the philosophy of human relationships, of language, of morality, and so on and so on. There are innumerable fields of the philosophy of. But back in the day of Socrates and his friends and his colleagues, the word philosophy meant something very, very, very different. It meant the practical pursuit of how to live a good life, like we spoke of last time under Epictetus, a life of virtue. In Greek, the word is eudaimonia, which translated can be happiness or welfare, or human flourishing or prosperity, or blessedness. And in Aristotle's work, which was called eudaimonia, based on an older Greek tradition, the word was used as for the highest human good. And so in short, it is the aim of a practical philosophy. So it wasn't something to study, but rather something to learn, a learning of a method of how to live, to apply practically in all spheres of living. Let me repeat that. Philosophy wasn't the study of some kind of ideas and theories about something unless it was related to the actual practical application on a day-to-day basis of how to live a life of either virtue or of eudaimonia or a life of dharma. Very similar to dharma in Buddhist teachings or Tao in Taoist teachings. So we see this parallel between the Chinese old philosophies of Taoism, the Indian old philosophy of Buddhism, and the Greek philosophy of the Greek philosophers, that philosophy was not something to philosophize about, but rather something to use every day. It was a tool. It wasn't something just to intellectualize about. It was a practical learning experience. How did it change? Why did it change? This is probably a subject that could be debated in many, and probably has been debated in many university courses. But I'm going to propose that the change and the loss of the original intent was related to the usurping of philosophical practice by politics and social control, which was implemented at the First Council of Nicea by demand and approval of the Emperor Constantine. Actually, when they usurped the new belief that was developing of Christianity to control the empire. Now, what does that mean? Jesus, if he lived or not, but let's assume he did, taught a certain philosophical structure and a certain philosophical way to live, a practical way to live. That was, interestingly enough, very much Judaic tradition. He was not teaching anything that was not in the Judaic tradition. As it grew into a greater belief system, the first century and in the second century and the beginning of the third century, it became very popularized because it was very open to many people. At that time, in that there was a Council of Nicea, it's been pronounced, and it was held in 320-something AD in Constantinople, where Emperor Constantine called all the people who had now become representatives of this new belief and said, I want to standardize the belief system. The good question is, why did he want to do that? Well, my theory is that with the basically unraveling of the Holy Roman Empire, they needed something more powerful than guns, more powerful than warfare, and more powerful than strength to control people. Well, what is more powerful than saying God is on my side, or the only God, or the one God? And so they took this new belief and transformed it from a very beautiful philosophy of compassion and love into a tool for social control. One of the first things in order to consolidate their social control would have to be making sure that they put out the message that our truth is the only truth and everybody else's truth is not. Everybody follow? And so any method of looking for some other kind of truth and connection to reality would suddenly have to be changed. That includes philosophy as a practical act, what we just discussed. It also includes using words and changing them so that when we referred to anything of the past, it was referred to as an undesirable, as opposed to something that was interesting, perhaps worth pursuing. And therefore, in addition with collecting all the philosophical books and all the science books and all the wisdom books over several hundreds, there is at least over 1,000, maybe 1,500 years, that version of what was called Christianity started to have a negative slant on everything that came before it. Now, I'm not speaking about what Jesus taught or about the belief of Christianity. I'm speaking about the political action that Emperor Constantine of the Holy Roman Empire took in order to consolidate belief and power. Now, okay, that sounds interesting. How can that be done? The fear of what is about to happen, what could happen, and that fear of change is how people were manipulated to reject what was in the past and accept what people were fed. This is the truth. I think that's how it still happens. We can see it in our own, in various countries around the world. Don't pay attention to that. If you want that, if you take that, your life is going to be destroyed. These people are going to come in. They're going to kill everybody, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Don't have to go into names, too obvious. And here, take this. This is going to be good for you. And so in that way, practical philosophy, practical use, and practical wisdom practices from the West actually were left behind and only resurfaced recently as the religious focus of our society shifted from organized religion to science. And these doors have started to open. So in that way, when we speak about philosophy, we speak about Stoicism, we speak about Buddha Dharma, or we speak about Taoist practice, we're speaking about something that has to be practical. I've said, I probably am like a broken record. I say practicality, practicality, practicality. It's not just Oren that's saying practicality, it's how it was taught. I believe that a similar thing has happened with Buddha Dharma that happened to Greek philosophy and Stoicism, in case this is what we're speaking about now, in that the Buddha came and offered something. And he said, here's a practical application. He didn't offer a religion. He offered, here's a practical application for life. And this application, there are many different levels. One level is just happiness. One level is balance. One level is more ease. However, if you want to go to deeper levels or higher levels, however one wants to position it, you can actually use this method to penetrate the very reality of what existence is all about. Does it make sense to everybody? Quinn, clear? Yeah. Sam, clear? Yeah. So at this point, I want to put in a footnote because we're going to go on and follow this up by reading and discussing this. I'll start from Buddha Dharma because that's where our discourse started from. The Buddha, I think, recognized very clearly that not everybody is going to want to go the full nine yards. Nirvana means extinguishing. We discussed that in a previous discourse. So when the Buddha offers Nirvana, He's not offering heaven and playgrounds and beautiful lights and rainbows. He's saying, done. The bliss that's offered is the bliss of complete merging with the universe, not the bliss of still identifying as some entity that's now having this very pleasant experience. He's not making a judgment that it should be for everybody. And as Buddha Dharma, the teachings developed from Theravadin, which I explained to you was the oldest form, into Mahayana, which was the next form, they evolved the vow of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva vow is that even though I might be able to walk through the doors of Nirvana today, I am not going to go through that door until I have made sure that every other sentient being has walked through before me. So in that statement is not only a statement of compassion, but it's also a statement of recognizing that perhaps I'm not walking through that door because I'm not really able to walk through that door yet. But at least if I'm not able to walk through that door, I can spend my life helping others move closer to the door. And I think from there, it moves on to Vajrayana, which is Tibetan and Nepal. We see a situation where they give them all these ceremonies, the tantric, right? The tantric practices. Now, tantra does not mean sex. It has nothing to do with sex. Tantra means using the physical form to transcend the physical form. And so tantra involves incense, it involves chanting, it involves yantra, which would be images, it involves doing those sand paintings. It involves yoga, which of some yogas were sexual yogas, but a lot of the yogas were not sexual. So it involves using the physical form to transcend. But see what happens now. We've moved from the oldest form, Theravadin, which is saying nirvana and extinguishing is it for everybody. Everybody has to become a bhikkhu or else no point. To Mahayana, where some people aren't really ready to become that extreme yet. And so they can become bodhisattvas or they can become householders, lay practitioners. And then we move to Vajrayana, which says, I'm going to give you all these ceremonies, all these practices that you can do so that whatever level you get to, you'll get to within your life. Do you see that transition, everyone? Yes, clear. Of course, this is my perspective. Everybody's got their opinion. That's my perspective on the whole thing. So it's not for us to say, if I commit to doing a Dharma practice, I have to be committed to extinguishing, to nirvana. One only has to commit to a Dharma practice because they want the benefits of the practice. Now, what are the benefits? The benefits of the practice are improved happiness and less suffering. And that's exactly what Epictetus is offering us as well. Epictetus says the same thing as the Buddha. Remember last week we read that section about you could get distracted, you may have to give up certain things at the very end? Remember we discussed that? Patrick made some comments. You recall that? It's in the notes. And Epictetus is saying if you really want to live the virtuous life, remember he used the word virtue, the virtuous life, eudaimonia in Greek, then you cannot put other things aside. You cannot say, I have to go to work today, so I can't do this, or I have to take care of my kids, so I can't do this, or I have to have a house, so I can't do this. He's saying, you have to prioritize that. But he recognized that not everybody can prioritize that. We have commitments. So he always offered all his students what they came in search of. And there are many stories about Epictetus talking to his students who wanted to know how to have better relationships, how to find a wife, how to have a better business, how to sail the sea, how to be a better politician. Epictetus himself was a philosopher, which means he lived the life, the virtuous life. None of that was for him. He was pursuing how to live a virtuous life. But he could offer from his experience to others how they could incorporate parts of that so that they would be happier and suffer less. A parallel to the Buddha. Understood? Clear? Okay, so let's go. We're going to start reading from the Satipatthana Sutta, part 2. And we're just going to read the... did everybody read the article about how reading out loud is better retained than reading quietly? You found that on the group channel. Therefore, as much as I love to read, and read out loud. And I know you all want me to read out loud. I love to hear you guys read so that you will retain better. So let's all go to the Satipatthana Sutta. We're going to start with reading that. And it starts with number two, the contemplation of feeling. And since Masha, you're on my right, we're going to read clockwise. So I want you to start with two, the contemplation of feeling. Everybody have the place? Now, in the Satipatthana, so the discourse of the arousing of mindfulness. It's in the number two, the contemplation of feeling after the contemplation of cemetery. Okay. Find it?
Got it.
Okay, so we'll start with Gregory. Masha, you haven't found it yet. So Gregory, you go ahead. You start. We're going to do counterclockwise. Okay, go ahead.
I guess I'm in the right place. The contemplation of feeling. And how, oh, because does a bhikkhu live contemplating feelings, feeling and feelings? Here, oh, because a bhikkhu, when experiences a pleasant feeling, understands, I experience a pleasant feeling. When experiences a painful feeling, he understands, I experience a painful feeling. When experiences a neither pleasant nor painful feeling, he understands, I experienced a neither pleasant nor painful feeling. When experience some pleasant worldly feeling, he understands, I experience a pleasant worldly feeling. When experience a pleasant spiritual feeling, he understands, I experience a pleasant spiritual feeling. When experience a painful worldly feeling, he understands, I experience a painful worldly feeling. When experience a painful spiritual feeling, he understands, I experience a painful spiritual feeling. When experience a neither pleasant nor painful worldly feeling, he understands, I experience a neither pleasant nor painful worldly feeling. When experience a neither pleasant nor painful spiritual feeling, he understands, I experience neither pleasant nor painful spiritual feeling. Thus he lives contemplating feelings and feelings internally, or he lives contemplating feeling and feelings externally, or he lives contemplating feeling and feelings internally and externally. He lives contemplating origination things and feelings, or he lives contemplating disillusion things and feelings, or he lives contemplating origination and disillusion things and feelings. Or his mindfulness is established with the thought, feelings exist to extent necessary just for knowledge and remembrance, and he lives independent and clings to naught in the world. Thus, indeed, because a bhikkhu lives contemplating feeling in feelings.
Okay, thank you. So, when Gregory finished, how many of you went, ugh? Not because Gregory didn't read it well, he read it wonderfully, but the actual content, right, Gregory? The content, do you notice how the content pushes us? It pushes us to recall, to go over and over and over, to come down to the specifics, to cover all the bases. Summing up that paragraph is really just what we've done so far with mindfulness, being attentive in all the possibilities, right? The possibilities of an external feeling, the possibilities of an internal feeling, a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, a pleasant feeling that's worldly, that's material, an unpleasant feeling that's worldly or material, a pleasant feeling that's spiritual or an unpleasant feeling that's spiritual, or a feeling that's neither spiritual, that's either pleasant or unpleasant, nor painful. Another thing we can see here, we're starting to see the division into three options. We have a positive option, a negative option, and a neither positive nor negative. Everybody see that?
Yeah.
And how that's developed. So he's giving us a structure with which to interpret the world. Oh, the rain just started. We interpret the world as it's raining. that's a pleasant thing for me. Or it's raining, oh, I don't like the rain. Or it's raining, it means nothing to me, I'm sitting here in a dry room. I don't, one way or the other, I don't have any thoughts about it. And so this is a structure, and this is a tool which you can use every day, okay? Your kids can call you on the phone and say, hey, you know, da 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 da, and right there you start to feel yourself react, you stop. How am I mindful about this? Am I now responding? Am I feeling inside about what I just heard? Pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, or an indifferent feeling? Understood? Once you have your feeling, you may decide to go ahead with it. You may be very upset at what you heard and decide to let it all out. You may be very happy with what you said and decide to let it out. Or you may be very indifferent and just say, well, that's nice. The fact that you can actually stop and put it into one of those three categories is one of the first steps towards being more mindful of how your mind works. Okay? There's a very specific reason why I'm saying this. I think we're not going to read number three there. I think we're going to move on from here directly to the Enchiridion. Okay? Because we got the flavor of that. So now let's go to...
That's with remember that desire, right?
Right, remember that desire. Number two in the Enchiridion, okay?
Remember that desire demands the attainment of that of which you are desirous, and aversion demands the avoidance of that to which you are averse. That he who fails of the object of his desires is disappointed, and he who incurs the object of his aversion is wretched. If then you shun only those undesirable things which you can control, you will never incur anything which you shun. But if you shun sickness or death or poverty, you will run the risk of wretchedness. Remove the habit of aversion then from all things that are not within our power, and apply to things undesirable which are within our power. But for the present, altogether restrain desire. For if you desire any of the things not within our own power, you must necessarily be disappointed. And you're not yet secure of those which are within our power, and so are legitimate objects of desire. Where it is practically necessary for you to pursue or avoid anything, do even this with discretion and gentleness and moderation.
Okay. Now, does that sound familiar? Does that at all, can you hear the relationship between that and what we just read in the Satipatthana Sutta?
Yeah.
Here we have, there are objects, we go to the beginning, that desire, remember that desire demands the attainment of that which you are desirous. And aversion demands the avoidance of that which you are averse. Pleasant, unpleasant, right? A pleasant feeling is that's what we desire. That's why it's pleasant. An unpleasant feeling is something that we don't want. That's why we avert it. And a person who fails, okay, in the object of desire is disappointed. Exactly what having attachment brings us to. So if you do not attach to the things that you find pleasurable, okay? Or if you do not try to go away, shun the things that are of the undesirable things that you control, you will never incur anything which you shun. But if you try to avoid things, take a position of pleasant or unpleasant on things that you cannot control, like here is sickness or death or poverty in this case, you will run the risk of wretchedness, of suffering. Now, when he says sickness, death, or poverty, many of us are trained in our society to say, well, I can control poverty, I just need to go out and work. So he's not saying not to make a decision to go out and to work. He's saying your current state of where you are as a current state, if you take a decision to try and make a point of it and not accept it the way it is, you're going to be suffering.